You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. Joining me now is Ben Woldofsky, Senior Vice President of National Engagement at Strata Education Network. Ben, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Ramona.
As we move into 2021, I want to talk about some of the challenges facing the workforce, and a lot of them have, you know, come to light. I think they've been, a lot of them have been in the system already, but with the massive unemployment and the focus on racial inequity, it feels like a lot of it has come to the surface now, and we are looking at these challenges with new eyes. So I want to talk to you a little bit about, what are you seeing? What are you looking at right now?
Well, look, I mean, challenges is kind of an understatement, right? You know, the economy has just been terrible, you know, the recession, COVID, a lot of, you know, real human suffering behind all the bad economic figures. I'd say, you know, some of these, as you kind of mentioned this, you know, some of these are pre-existing sort of concerns, but they've really been amplified and speeded up by, you know, COVID and the recession. Just to sort of briefly review some of them, you know, we of course have this recession, and what that really means for the labor market, of course, is lots of lost jobs, but also very fast changing needs in terms of which sectors actually might have some openings and might need people with certain kinds of skills where there may or may not be a good supply. In general, you know, we kind of continue to have this real disconnect between supply and demand for skilled workers. Equity, of course, has been a huge concern, you know, for the country this year in particular. This really comes up a lot when you look at people's pathways between education and training and work, and not always having the kind of access or the kind of guidance or navigation assistance that they need to find the right pathway. There's people kind of talking past each other between the employer world and the education world, not necessarily having a common language to match skills with demand. And then there's a lot of different players involved in the supply and demand. And that could be everybody from the individuals, you know, who are looking for work or trying to improve their skills. They, you know, call it reskilling or upskilling. The education providers who are trying to make sure that their programs are relevant and useful. The employers who are trying to figure out, you know, what the kinds of people they need and how do they reach out to the right places to get the kind of talent they need. So there's just many different challenges ahead of us.
Employers, they've had to shift so much over these last 9 months. Do you think that they are at this point able to very clearly state what they need? Because I think that's a key important, like, starting point when before you can even talk about what education can do to help the workforce.
It varies. I think that the knock on employers sometimes, you know, from let's say the higher ed side, is they want, you know, they want the people with the skills that they need for the opening that they have right this minute, or that the person they're going to need to walk in the door tomorrow, but they may not be thinking longer term in terms of, you know, economists talk about human capital, you know, the kind of human capital that they're going to need in terms of maybe it's the analytical skills, or people talk about the soft skills or the human skills, which might be communicating, you know, working well with other people, leadership. There's a lot of things which are actually also quite important to many employers, but which they don't necessarily make their top priority, and they don't always articulate that effectively.
One of the things in this new report that you have just put out on bridge builders is talking about the role of an intermediary.
Yep.
Can you define what is an intermediary in this report?
Well, it's a great question. You know, one of the reasons we called the report bridge builders is, you know, bridge builders feels like a little less of a wonky term than intermediary. But we also decided, look, intermediary is a term that's very commonly used in the field. We decided we should just own it. So we do use it in the report. But a bridge builder is a little more descriptive. You know, intermediaries basically bring people together. You know, you can call them bridge builders. You can call them conveners. They span boundaries. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, I don't know if this analogy is perfect, but, you know, when there's a really complex, you know, legal case, you know, sometimes there'll be some kind of a mediation where many different parties have to come to the table together to hash out their differences and come up with what, you know, you hope will be a workable solution. And in a sense, an intermediary is like that. They're getting the right parties at the table. The wrinkle is that sometimes an intermediary, because they take so many different forms, they could be one of the parties. So, you know, sometimes higher education can take the lead in being an intermediary. Sometimes employers can take the lead. You know, a lot of chambers of commerce are very involved in this work. So they can take many different forms. One of the things that's great about them is whether it's, you know, a nonprofit intermediary or an employer or an education provider, they can really be, they can tailor the kind of work they do and the specific details of who they bring together based on the needs of the community or the region or the state that they're working in. So they can be very, they can be very tailored.
Could you share with me some examples of intermediaries that have been effective in the past? What are they doing right?
We really did try in this report to really come up with some really specific examples of where intermediaries, you know, both in the United States and in a bunch of other countries, where they've been successful, because that doesn't mean that everyone's doing it right, but it means that we have some really good models of what's already been working so that this isn't something that people have to invent from scratch. And I'll just give you like a very basic example. You know, one example that I really like, you know, well, there's a couple of reasons I like it. I mean, you know, when you're working on a report, we had some really fantastic, you know, global experts from different parts of the world, you know, people who'd worked at places like the World Bank or the OECD, you know, really knew a lot. But we did not want this to appear to be something where the rest of the world has all the answers and, you know, we in the States are backward, you know, we don't know anything. Because in fact, there's a lot happening in the United States that's really been very effective. And one example I really like is in Mobile, Alabama. You know, they've been very effective at attracting some really big employers. You know, they've gotten, there's the European aircraft manufacturer Airbus, there's an engineering company from Norway, there's a stainless steel producer from Finland. You know, and Mobile, you know, has a very large deep water port. It's the ninth biggest in the States. They appear to have a very successful local education infrastructure, you know, public schools with high graduation rates, public community colleges, public university nearby. So there seemed to be every reason why it was going to be a great setting. But it turned out that, you know, as these companies came in, they started discovering it was really hard for them to find the talent that they needed. And it turned out that, you know, the high school system had sort of been inflating its graduation rate. A lot of students who did graduate either weren't going to college, or if they went to college, they would drop out, or they would maybe try to transfer from community college, but they would find their credits weren't accepted. So there were just a lot of problems with the sort of the way the education system was working or not working on the ground to get people better education and to help meet the kinds of needs of the employer community. So what happened is a bunch of different community organizations got together. You know, there were civic organizations, industry organizations, churches were involved, and they set a very specific goal that they wanted to have 75,000 Mobile residents earn new degrees by 2030. They worked through this small nonprofit. It's called the Mobile Area Education Foundation, and that's the intermediary. And they helped coordinate all these different constituencies, and they created this campaign called Graduate Ready. And, you know, it's really been extremely effective. You know, the businesses have been involved working with the education providers to try to design programs of study that are really in sync with what people need in the workplace. They have also added some components that we know, you know, are often very helpful for students and for businesses, like internships, apprenticeships. They even would send employees into the schools to be reading buddies. So they really tried to sort of break down some of those walls to try to bring these different worlds closer together. And then, you know, at the higher ed level, you know, universities did things like simplify the transfer process for people who were trying to transfer from community colleges so that, you know, people weren't spending a lot of money getting credits that they couldn't end up counting toward a degree. And, you know, they were doing things like there's sometimes a tendency, you know, to say, oh, you shouldn't take too many credits, you know, per semester because it's going to be too hard on you, which is actually kind of a false kindness, because it turns out that you really have to stay on track to graduate if you really want to have a good chance of graduating. So long story short, after all of these changes were made, you know, the high school graduation rates went way up. The number of students who transferred from community colleges to the public university more than tripled. And they basically created, you know, a mechanism through this intermediary to try to, you know, make some of the changes that were needed, but that individuals or individual institutions couldn't necessarily see on their own. You know, there's this kind of old saying, you know, if everyone's in charge, no one's in charge. And I think one of the things that really works well with successful intermediaries is they just perform this kind of coordinating role, which doesn't sound super sexy, but it's actually incredibly important.
That's a fantastic example, and it shows how having that intermediary can really help, but also just the collaboration that sounds like it was going on between the companies and the community and the education system there. Fantastic. I'd be looking forward to seeing the, you know, 2030, the outcomes of this whole,
absolutely.
Whole experiment.
Absolutely.
So an important thing in there that I was thinking as we were talking earlier too, is the inequitable access to some pathways. Is mobile an example of how that was addressed, or is there another example that can show us, you know, how making those pathways and those opportunities accessible for everyone is really important in this whole recovery area?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think mobile is an example of that. I mean, of course, you know, here's where, of course, I'm going to say, well, read the report because it's got tons of examples, you know, from across the U.S. and all in other countries as well. And I'd say, depending on, you know, how you define equity, they're not all necessarily about, you know, race or ethnic, you know, equity, although that's often a component. But more broadly, you know, it's equity for people who just have not been getting great opportunities, whoever they are. So, I mean, thinking in the UK, for example, there's something called the Civic University Commission, and they created a network called the Civic University Network, where they got more than 100 universities working together. What they were contending with was that a lot of universities just were not really closely connected with their local communities, where there were often some real economic problems. And so local people were not getting the kind of access to education and training that would really help them in the workforce. And the universities really kind of stepped up and tried to make a better effort to do that. So just in one other kind of UK example in Manchester, which is kind of related, you know, they found that the area that was really growing around there with a lot of, you know, better paid jobs and fast growing jobs were in, you know, kind of technology, you know, digital stuff, but that they were bringing in a lot of people from outside the area because local people did not necessarily have those skills. And so one of the things that happened through this effort, you know, through an intermediary, was to really try to create better access to courses in school, in you know, local educational institutions that would give people some of those kinds of skills that were really in demand. So I guess I would say that really is a form of equity as well.
Overall, do you think education is rising to the occasion? Do you think they're finding new ways to help create a dynamic, upskilled workforce?
In the United States, you know, of course, we have a very vast and really varied post-secondary education system. Everything from huge numbers of community colleges to large state universities to sort of the much more selective research-oriented state flagships to the privates, which in turn can be the super elite, you know, research-oriented privates to the small schools, sometimes religious schools that may be really good at teaching but aren't necessarily big in the research. So we just have a lot of different kinds of things going on. And so whether or not people are rising to the occasion really depends. I guess one way to think about it is this. You can think of reform as kind of working within the system and trying to create new and better systems. So I would say working within the system, there is certainly very wide recognition that we need to do a better job getting more people into education after high school because the economy has changed and it's become more and more important to have some kind of post-secondary education. We also know there's a huge problem with non-completion of degrees, for example. So there's a lot of efforts being made by many different, you know, colleges and universities to improve retention and completion and to really try to avoid the situation where you have people graduating with debt but no degree, which is really the worst of both worlds. So there's a lot of stuff happening to try to keep, you know, this sort of existing system functioning, well, to really make it function better. And that would include, I think, people who are really being thoughtful will try to give students exposure to the kinds of work opportunities they might have in the future, and will try to be recognize the fact that most people go to college because they're interested in their careers. That's a very big motivator. But at the same time, there's just a lot of work going on a sort of different track, which is like, let's rethink the system. Maybe we need to break down some of those barriers, reduce some of the credentialism that makes people expect credentials for jobs that perhaps don't need them. So there's a lot of research and thinking going on about how can you get people to hire more for skills? How can you do away with credential requirements when they're not really necessary? And I think, you know, you can certainly make the case for both the kind of reforming the system from within and trying to carve out new ways of doing things. But ultimately, you know, you don't have to pick. It really, it's not going to be either or. It's going to be both and.
You know, the work you've done over the years in education and now at Strata, is that a mind shift, though? Is it? I mean, I've always heard that higher education is kind of rigid in the way things should be. You know, there's some very longstanding beliefs. I feel like with the people I've talked to, I've seen this mind shift over the last couple of years. And again, as you use the word, accelerated by the pandemic.
It's kind of, is the glass half full or is it half empty? You know, I do think, I mean, look, I have a lot of fondness for higher education, but I also have a real recognition of all the ways in which it falls short and needs to be reformed, right? I think that, yeah, there are certainly people who just don't want to talk about careers or people's professional prospects because they're really only interested in a very pure notion of the life of the mind. That's slow to change in some places, but I think increasingly universities and colleges are, whether or not they use this exact language, you know, they're in a marketplace. They're trying to attract students. They're trying to come up with things that will get people to enroll. They certainly, I think, they want their graduates to be successful, however the graduates may define that. So I think there is, you know, look, I mean, if you look at the most popular majors, you know, people may say that academics are all kind of in the ivory tower, but, you know, business, I think, is by far the most popular undergraduate major in the country. Whatever you think of business as a major, you know, that's a fact. I think STEM is, of course, very popular, you know, computer science. So I think that the offerings have certainly moved in the direction where consumer demand is. The question, I think, is partly a little broader, which is whether or not we might make it easier for people to do certain kinds of work while they're in school, whether it's apprenticeships or internships, whether it's getting credit for certain kinds of experience. Basically, there's a lot of different factors that sort of fall under the category of, you know, both guidance and opportunities to sort of test the waters to see. And maybe if you're an English major, but, you know, maybe you can get some experience in a summer job where you'll see, what does it really mean to sort of synthesize complex information and communicate it clearly, you know? And how can you draw the connection between some of the really useful stuff you're doing in your English classes when you're doing literary analysis, but you might try to understand a little more clearly how that's going to carry over into the working world. And I think that doesn't take away from the pursuit of knowledge or the truth, but it can be really appealing to students who are looking for those connections between education and the world they're going to be living in afterward.
As we move into 2021, as we begin the year, do you feel optimistic that we can address these challenges and that we're going to be able to, you know, create a stronger post-COVID economy?
I would like to think of myself as an optimist, you know, overall, because I feel like certainly when it comes to, look, there are a lot of things that, you know, I can't claim to, you know, have any, I wish I had some insight into the vaccines and the post-COVID world and all that stuff. And I don't. I think we're moving in a good direction, but it's going to really, you know, we'll see what happens with the facts on the ground. I think with education, this country really does have, I think, a great historical trajectory of moving toward greater and greater access and opportunity to education. Does not mean it has been perfect by any means, and there are still lots of inequity and lots of problems that remain. But, you know, if you look at just things like high school graduation becoming, you know, just increasingly common in the last 100 years, going on to post-secondary education becoming more and more common, you know, people earning degrees, whether associates or four-year degrees, also become more and more common. The variety of people earning those degrees, not as great variety as it should be, but it's definitely improved, you know, over the last 50 years. So a big picture way of looking at it is I think that the historical patterns are all there. And if we can continue in that direction, you know, more access, more completion, more credentials that really have the kind of value that people are looking for, I think that there's reason to be optimistic in the near term. And a sort of very different way of answering your question is, I think that, you know, in a marketplace where there's been really declining enrollment, there's a lot of people, you know, we know this from the surveys that we do at Strata, a lot of people are really believe they're going to need more education to, you know, to get back on their feet or to advance in the workforce, but they're not quite sure what they need and how to go about it. There is a real need for navigation assistance, and we're going to see some institutions stepping up. And I think we may need have others where, you know, something like intermediaries are really going to be necessary to just put the right people together to show what needs to be done.
Ben, I appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts and your insight on the subject with me. And thank you for being candid about your answers.
Well, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it, Ramona. Thanks for having me.
My thanks today to Ben Wadowski, Senior Vice President of National Engagement at Strata Education Network. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Thank you for listening.